Welcome to I Wish They Knew, a show where leaders in business and education share big ideas that deserve more attention in about the time it takes to enjoy a cup of coffee. I'm Joe Hirsch. Today's wish comes from Jonah Berger. Jonah is a marketing professor at Wharton, an internationally best-selling author, and a world-renowned expert on change, word of mouth, social influence, consumer behavior, and how products, ideas, and behaviors catch on. He joined us back on episode 74, and we're excited to have him back here for another wish today. His work has appeared in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and Harvard Business Review, and Jonah has consulted for organizations like Apple, Google, Nike, Amazon, GE, 3M, and the Gates Foundation. Jonah's latest book is Magic Words, What to Say to Get Your Way. Jonah, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me back.
So what do you wish more people knew?
You know, what's so interesting is that almost everything we do involves language. So if we think about sending emails, writing presentations, making pitches, making phone calls, talking to bosses and colleagues, even our private thoughts rely on language. And certainly how we talk to our family members at home rely on language. But while we spend a lot of time thinking about the content we want to communicate, so in a presentation, for example, we say, okay, I want to make sure, you know, this is my big idea. I want to make sure to get this big idea across. We spend a lot less time thinking about the specific words we use when communicating those ideas. And unfortunately, that's a mistake because subtle shifts in the language we use can have a big effect on our overall impact. Nice research, for example, shows that adding just a particular word to a request makes people about 50% likely to say yes. Rather than saying we like something, saying we recommend it makes others about a third more likely to take our suggestion. And everything from the language we use in the emails we send at the office to the language we might use when applying for a loan, for example, sheds important insight on who people are and what they're likely to do in the future. You can predict, for example, whether someone's going to get promoted or fired based on how similar the language they use in their email is to the language in their colleague's email. And so the big question for me is kind of, you know, how can we use language more effectively? There are clearly magic words that do more work than other words and are more impactful. What are these magic words and how by understanding them can we use their power?
What really struck me in the book is that these magic words aren't even magical. Like you said, they're almost mechanical, a shift here and a nuance there. Give us an example of how that applies in terms of building people's sense of self and getting what we want.
Sure. Yeah. And so you're very right. They're not actually magical. So for some people, they may be disappointed. For others, they may be heartened to hear that. But, you know, all of this is based on science and research. The last 10 years have seen an amazing growth in both the availability of language data. Right? You and I are talking right now. You can hit a button afterwards and get a transcription of everything we talked about. We've looked at thousands of customer service calls, tens of thousands of social interactions, hundreds of thousands of pieces of online content and looked at how the language that are used in those things shapes their overall impact. And so not magic, very much based on science, but there are kind of six key types of magic words that I talk about in the book. And I put them in a framework called the SPEAK framework. The S is for the language of similarity and difference. The P is for the language of posing questions. The E is for the language of emotion. The A is for the language of agency and identity. The first C is the language of confidence, and the second C is the language of concreteness. And if your listeners are sitting there going, wait a second, that doesn't actually spell speak. Speak should have a K at the end rather than two Cs. I'm glad they're paying attention. They are completely right. Speak should have a K at the end. I was not clever enough to come up with an acronym with a K, though somebody did point out that K is the most difficult letter to use in Scrabble. So I do feel a little bit better there. But I'll give you just one example from the agency and identity chapter of how we can use language more effectively. So many of us are trying to influence others, trying to get other people to do something we'd like them to do. We might ask for help if we're a nonprofit. We may ask people to turn out to vote. There's a variety of things we want people to do. Is there a way we could make them more likely to say yes? And so a number of decades ago, some researchers at Stanford University went to a local preschool and they asked some students to help clean up. classroom. It was a mess. There were crayons on the floor and books everywhere. And the scientists asked the students to help them clean up. And so for some students, they did exactly that. They said, hey, can you help clean up? But for another set of students, they tried a subtly but importantly different approach. They said, hey, can you be a helper and clean up? Now, the difference between help and helper is tiny, infinitesimally small, only a couple of letters. Let that subtle shift, those couple letters at the end, led to about a 30% increase in the likelihood that students ended up helping. And it's not just students in a classroom, right? Many of us, I think, may think that's great, but, you know, we want to change adults' behavior in the field in more consequential situations. So in a more recent study, researchers looked at voting, a big behavior that takes a bit of work, and they looked at whether language might encourage people to vote. They asked some people, hey, can you please go vote? And for another set of people, they said, hey, can you be a voter and go vote? And again, very subtle shift from vote to voter, yet that shift led to about a 15% increase in the portion of people who voted. And 15% may not seem like a lot, but on a measure like voting, it's a pretty big deal. And so why? Why did helper work better than help? Why did voter work better than vote? And it turns out this has to do with the difference between actions and identities. So we often ask people to take actions, to help, vote, to do a variety of other things. And people want to take those actions, but they're busy. They don't always have time. But what they care more about than actions are desired identities, right? We all want to see ourselves positively, as smart, as knowledgeable, as efficacious, competent, whatever you like. And so when actions become opportunities to claim desired identities, we're much more likely to take those actions, right? If we want to see ourselves as a runner, we've got to run once in a while, for example. And so rather than just cleaning up being helping, which is a nice thing, if cleaning up is an opportunity to see myself as a helper, now I'm more likely to do it, right? If voting is not just an action, but an opportunity to see myself as a voter, which is a desirable identity, I'm much more likely to do it. And the same actually holds with negative things, but in the opposite direction. Right? Losing is bad, but being a loser would be even worse. Cheating on a test is a bad thing, obviously, but being a cheater, being branded a cheater would be terrible, right? And so research finds that if cheating would make students a cheater, if they're told, hey, if you cheat on this test, that would make you a cheater, they're much less likely to cheat because they don't want to do something that would claim that undesired identity. And so it reminds me of that old anti-littering campaign, don't be a litter bug, right? Littering, yeah, is a negative thing. If you tell people don't litter, they'll say, sure, fine. But if you tell them don't be a litter bug, which is a negative thing, they want to avoid actions that would avoid claiming that identity. And so, you know, not only can we use this to change others' behaviors, to get them to help or vote or do a variety of things, we can even use it to change how people perceive us, right? If I said, hey, I have two friends, one runs and one is a runner, who would you guess runs more? Of those two people?
Oh, definitely the runner.
Yeah, right. Because it sounds like that's who they are, right? That's part of who they are. They do that all the time. If I said, you know, at the beginning of the segment, you mentioned the time it takes to drink a cup of coffee. Somebody says, hey, I drink coffee, versus someone says, I am a coffee drinker, right? Well, if they are a coffee drinker, that's who they are. It's part of their identity. It's persistent. And so when we're describing positive traits like hardworking, innovative, creative, the more we make those identities, I'm a creator, I'm an innovator, I'm a hard worker, the more those things seem persistent and long lasting. Similarly, on the negative side, you know, if we fail, we don't want to see ourselves as a failure. We want to see ourselves as failing. You know, this particular thing failed. And so avoiding those sort of more persistent, more trait attributions of negative things. And so subtle shifts in language from actions to identities can change how people perceive themselves and how likely they are to take related action.
Yeah, it's almost like words provide the will.
I think that's a nice way of saying it. Yeah, words certainly change the meaning of things, right? So what we're talking about now is this language of agency identity. Words not only say, you know, what somebody is supposed to do or direct or collect information, it's just what it means to do something. What does it mean to clean up? Sometimes it means you're helping, and sometimes it means you're a helper. Right? We can even think about the language of agency, right? How much we seem in control of actions. There was some nice work in customer service, for example, showing that when customer service agents use the word I rather than we, you know, so I can help you with this rather than we can help you with this, it makes listeners feel like, well, that customer service agent has more agency and they're going to solve my problem. They're going to take care of it. right? Similarly, the word you can suggest some things about agency. I was doing a big project a couple of years ago with a large consumer electronics firm, analyzing all their both their social media content and their help pages and the language that increased impact. So on customer service pages, or sorry, on social media pages, we found the word you was really beneficial. The more posts use the word you, the more people engaged with that content. They liked it, the more they shared it, in part because you acts like a stop sign. You as a flag, right? It's not just five tips to help. It's five tips to help you. Well, hold on. If it's speaking to me, I'm more likely to look at it. At the same time, though, when we looked at the language of help pages, so you go, your computer's broken, your phone needs to be connected to something, there we found the opposite effect. You in those situations hurt. And why did it hurt? Well, the more a page says, hey, if your phone is broken, you need to do this, the more the reader can feel like, well hold on, why is it my fault, right? Why is it my job to fix this? Why do I need to do all this work? It's your phone that's broken in the first place. And so you can often feel rather accusatory. It can suggest that someone's responsible or blameworthy. Even in our personal lives, you know, if someone said, did you finish that report? Someone can feel like, well, why are you signaling me out, right? It's more like, you know, is the report finished, is a way of saying it without that word you, and is less likely to make someone feel blamed.
Yeah, it's less of a judgment and more of an opportunity.
Certainly. I mean, I think you suggest who's in control, who's in charge, who's responsible for an action, and as does the word I. And so there's lots of examples where subtle shifts in language can have a big impact, even something as simple as should versus could. So I also talk about this in the agency identity chapter, but you know, often we're trying to solve difficult problems. We wish we could be more creative. We often think about what we should do. It's a standard way to think about it. But in a very nice study, researchers instead encourage participants to think about what they could do. Don't think about what you should do. Think about what you could do. And they found that encouraging people to think about what they could rather than should do led people to come up with more creative solutions and better solutions to problems, because should really focuses on one narrow answer, like there's one right thing, what is it? Whereas could makes us think more broadly and explore a little bit. Right? And maybe not all those options are good ideas, maybe not all of them are worth pursuing, but at least by considering a broader set of options, we're more likely to reach a better outcome.
You talk in the book about the power of asking for advice, which I guess when you think about agency, can sometimes hold people back because they feel like if they have to ask for advice, they worry about looking bad. You don't necessarily think that's true, do you?
Yeah. And by the way, what I would say is, yes, it's not just that I don't think it's true, but it's also that the data thinks that it's true. So what, you know, I'm not the first one to have written a book about language, but if you look at a lot of the books out there that have been on language, a lot of them are just anecdotes, right? There's somebody's opinion about how language might work. And what I love about the work that we and others have done in this space over the past few decades is we can now say conclusively, look, this works, right? So take asking for advice. You know, often we want to ask for advice. We're stuck on something. We know somebody who could help. We want their help, but we're worried. We're worried they're going to bother them, worried that they're not going to know the answer. Even worse, even if they do, they'll think less of us for asking. And so we don't ask for advice, but it turns out that intuition is quite misguided. So some researchers from Wharton did a really nice study where they asked a variety of different people to interact in a variety of sort of conversation contexts. In some contexts, people asked for advice. And in others, they didn't. And they looked how people were perceived, the people were perceived who asked for advice versus didn't. And they found that it wasn't the case that asking for advice made people seem less positive, less knowledgeable, less competent. In fact, just the opposite. Asking for advice made people seem more competent, more knowledgeable. You might say, well, why would that be? Why would asking for advice be helpful? And the reason is that it plays on people's egocentrism. Right? So all of us love to feel like we give good advice. We're knowledgeable, we're smart, we give good advice. So when someone comes along and asks us for our advice, we go, wow, that person's pretty smart because of all the people they could have asked, they picked me. And so not only is asking advice good because it allows us to collect information and gain insight, but it can lead us to be perceived more positively as a result. And this is just one example of questions. There's a whole chapter with other sort of techniques and approaches here. But I think questions, good questions, are really powerful. We think about questions allowing us to collect information, but they shape how we're perceived. They also act like searchlights, kind of drawing attention to certain things or directing the nature of the conversation. And so they can be a really powerful linguistic tool to increase our impact in a variety of situations.
It's like that old fundraising adage, ask for money, you get advice. ask for advice, you get money.
You know, I haven't heard that before, but I like that. I like that a lot.
Yeah. Well, I think we have we've covered only some of the book, but I think our words are spent for right now. There's much more to unpack here and maybe in a part two. But folks, if you have not yet picked up a copy of Magic Words, you need to do so right now. It will be magical. The book is Magic Words. The author is Jonah Berger. Jonah, thanks for sharing your wish with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you heard, please rate and review the show. It helps others find us. For more ideas on how to communicate with impact, visit my website, joehirsch.me. See you next time.